God has intervened to make Jacob start becoming very wealthy. I think Dr. Britt made a good point where he said, taking away the wealth of Laban. Well, Laban had all those flocks. They should have continued to increase. It might just have been they weren't increasing at near the rate they had been before. So, you know, we're making jokes about baseline budgeting where if you don't have the increase you expect, you call it a decrease when it might still actually be an increase. We're not certain about that, but Laban's flocks and those of his other sons or his sons seem to be increasing a lot more slowly than Jacob's. So Jacob goes to meet with his two wives to see if they're willing to go, you know, which is a good thing. Before you decide, hey, we're going to move, pick up everything we have and move, it's good for the husband and wife to get together and agree on that. And they give an interesting answer in verse 14. Rachel and Leah answered and said, well, is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? He has completely sold us and completely consumed our money. Now, it's not certain, but I've read some discussion and speculation that at that time, some fathers apparently would keep a dowry. Like if they got a dowry for their daughter, they would put it aside and save it as a trust to later give to the grandchildren or to the daughter. So if that was the case here, they're saying Laban didn't do that, but instead used up the wealth that Jacob had made for him. So I said, this is speculation, but that could explain what they're saying. They could also be saying, look, Dad basically sold us, you know. It's like he wanted a dowry and he used us to get it. So they properly put their loyalty to their husband first. You know, they say, we're willing to go. Verse 16, all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. So this is appropriate that we have this stuff. So then whatever God has said to you, do it. One of the things I put a note of here, I think it's good to always keep in mind that in a good family relationship, which all of us want to have good family relationships, a wife shouldn't be put in a situation of having to choose between her parents and her husband. You know, so no husband should put his wife in that situation. Likewise, a wife shouldn't put her husband in that situation where you got to choose between the rest of your family and her. You want to work together to make decisions that everyone's happy with. Now, in some cases, you know, one person might be a little less happy with the decision than the other. Again, I remember when, you know, I was offered the opportunity to come and work for the church. My wife was a little less thrilled at first than I was, but we both considered it. We got a lot of advice. We both fasted, you know, and then made the commitment together that we would do it. But, you know, whereas my first instinct was, well, yeah, I'm going to do that. She said, well, wait a minute, let's think about this. And it was good that we both considered together. So it's good that Jacob is having this meeting and that the daughters both agree or his wives agree. It's just a shame that they had to do it this way. At any rate, we see verse 17, Jacob arose, set his sons and wives on camels, carried away all his livestock and possessions which he'd gained to go to his father in Canaan. Laban had gone to shear his sheep. Oh, yeah, well, I was going to pause and say something else about this. It might seem kind of odd. Wow, they packed up all their stuff and they're gone just like that. Because I'm thinking, how many of you have helped a friend move? You know, if you've ever had that thing where you have a bunch of people and you're all day carrying stuff out to a U-Haul, and, you know, it seems surprisingly easy how they just pick up and go. Well, in that era, they probably had just fewer possessions. As I said, they didn't have color TVs and chest of drawers and lots of furniture. And they were living in tents, probably nice tents that weren't like the nylon things with the bendy poles that pack up so quickly and easily that we use today. But still, they were a much more portable society. So they're able to pick up their stuff and be gone pretty quickly, even without even Laban knowing about it. And that was what Jacob had in mind. He's a little nervous that Laban won't let him go willingly. Now, of course, as I said, verse 19, Laban had gone to shear a sheep. Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. Not a good move. That word for idols, household, is teraphim. That's a word we see come up a few times. And note, remember the I-M is plural, so it could be teraphs. Later in verse 30... And in verse 32, Laban refers to them as gods. And the word there he uses, Elohai, E-L-O-H-A-I. So, teraphim, what I'm getting at is he's seeming to think of these as gods. They're idols. Which, I say, sometimes teraphim is a word they would use to something that people would... They would use the word teraphim to refer to something that people might think of as like a good luck charm. Now, we don't believe in good luck charms either. But it seems that Laban saw these as more than just like a horseshoe or a rabbit's foot. Charlie, your hand looked poised. Okay, so why did Rachel steal them? Okay, there's two possibilities, and maybe both are partly true. One is she might have believed they have some mystical power. Well, maybe like a good luck charm, or maybe she's still believing there's more than one God. There's a chance, though, that she didn't think that, but they're made out of gold and silver, and she's thinking, hey, Dad's been swindling us and didn't save any of the dowry for the kids. I'm going to take some of what he's got. Either way, she's doing wrong, because saying, well, this should have been mine and I'm going to take it, still amounts to stealing. And of course, believing it's some type of good luck charm or a type of God, that's wrong because it's idolatry. Yeah, Julie?
Well, what is the second Hebrew?
Hebrew, Elohai, it means God or gods. And I was making the contrast because Laban calls them that. So he seems to think of them as more than good luck charms. He thinks of them as idols. So anyways, she has these. So there's something to consider as they're moving on. Verse 20, Jacob stole away unknown to Laban the Syrian. Didn't tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had, and he headed towards the mountains of Gilead. So they're heading, you know, down this way, the mountains of Gilead. There's a variety of how you could interpret it. I should mention Gilead is the name that it's given later when the children of Israel go in. That's the area where, remember, Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh want to settle there because it's good for livestock. So they'll name it Gilead. Apparently Moses is calling it that when he writes this, or perhaps someone even later inserts that name. As I said, there are some place names that make people think maybe a later editor put them in. And a common belief is perhaps Ezra the scribe, he's believed to have brought all the books together that would be the final version of the Old Testament. And it doesn't matter that much, but it's the type of thing that some scholars will say, see, all this was really made up after the Babylonian captivity. It wasn't written by Moses. There wasn't really a Moses. I don't think that's true. There's an easy explanation for why names that came into existence later could be put into this early account. Does that make sense what I'm saying? Okay. Didn't mean to spend a long time just talking about Gilead, but so they're moving along. Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. This is in verse 22. Verse 23, he took his brethren with him and pursued him 7 days' journey and overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. So Jacob had good reason to say, hey, Laban might not let me go. Laban comes after him. And he brings helpers. And maybe, we don't know for sure if Laban intends to do Jacob harm. It seems there's a fair chance that he does, but God is going to intervene and speak to Laban. So mostly we see God speaking to those who are devoted servants. God appears and speaks to Abraham. He speaks to Isaac, then to Jacob. But remember, God spoke to Abimelech earlier and said, hey, don't touch Sarah. She belongs to someone else. So God is going to speak to Laban. Matter of fact, I'll make this point. We don't know for sure how much Laban knew of and worshipped the true God. There's some indication that he did, and that his father did. Especially, remember when Abraham's servant comes to find Rebekah to take her back to Isaac, and he explains this miracle, the family said, well, this obviously is from God, let Rebekah go. So at one point, they seem to know something of the true God. But then again, Laban's got these household idols. Doesn't seem that he's a very devoted worshiper of God. Maybe he's been, you know, he's been drifting, influenced by the people around him, and he realizes this is surely some powerful God. Look at how Jacob's blessed. Look at what's happening. But maybe he's practicing what we now call syncretism, meaning adding different religions together. And so, okay, that God that Jacob is worshiping, I'll add him to my list. You know, and I'm also worshiping Baal and Ashtaroth and maybe some others. And again, I'm speculating, there isn't a place that says Laban is doing that, but it would seem as a possibility why he does this. And anyways, you know, he's going to be warned by this particular God, and he'll take it seriously. Let's go on. Laban overtook Jacob. Jacob has pitched his tent. In verse 26, Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me? Carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword." It's like you kidnapped them. "Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me? I might have sent you away with joy, songs, timbrel, and harp." You know, he says, "We could have had a big party and celebrate your leaving. You didn't allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. You've done foolishly in so doing." He says, "It's in my power to do you harm, but..." Oh, and I skipped over verse 24, where it first happens. Verse 24 is where God had come to Laban in a dream and said, "Be careful that you speak to Jacob, neither good nor bad." So there's where I say, now he knows this is a real God. And whether or not he was intending to do harm, now he limits his complaints to, "Hey, why didn't we get to have a party? I didn't get to kiss my grandchildren goodbye. And your God warned me, but still, you know, why steal my gods?" he says. And in verse 30, "Now you've surely gone away and because you greatly long for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods?" Again, here it's not the word teraphim, it's the word that means gods. Jacob said, "Well, I was afraid. I thought perhaps you'd take your daughters from me by force." And so he gives a brief explanation. "Well, that's why I did it secretly. But as far as stealing your stuff," he said, "with whomever you find your gods, don't let him live. And in the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you." You know, for Jacob didn't know that Rachel had stolen them. So it's worth noting that Jacob here seems to be pronouncing just a general curse. Like, you know, whoever, you know, anybody to do something like this, let thunder come down or whatever. Not that he's pronouncing a legal sentence, like the death sentence is the penalty for theft. And at any rate, he's thinking, "I know I didn't steal these." And he never dreams that his wives, doesn't dream that Rachel would have stolen them. Laban's going to go ahead and search. Jacob challenges him and says, "Okay, I'm going to check it out." Goes to Jacob's tent, Leah's tent, the two maids' tents. He went out of Leah's tent, entered Rachel's tent. "Now Rachel hid in the household items and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Laban searched all the tent, but he didn't find them. And she said, 'Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me.' He searched and he couldn't find them." What this is saying is Rachel said, "Look, it's my time of the month. I'm sorry, you know, I can't stand up. I want to comment, this isn't my surmising, but I've had people tell me that girls have used this as an excuse through the ages. Not that anyone here would necessarily do that, but she gets away with it. He doesn't say, "Stand up, I want to look in that saddle." So now Jacob feels justified and he lets his anger out. Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban. He answered, "What's my trespass? What's my sin? You've hotly pursued me, saying, 'You come after me like a criminal. You searched all my stuff. What part of you? Know, what part of your things have you found with my stuff? Set it here before our brethren.'" And he's saying, "My brethren and your brethren." Since, remember, Laban is the uncle and Jacob is the nephew, so they're family. So this is all family together. So he said, "Bring it all out in front of our family." And then he does something that is not good for interpersonal relationships. So he's going to bring up past grievances. And I'm saying that's not something we should be in the habit of doing. You know, you have a grievance or you're upset about something, talk about the issue at hand. Don't bring up stuff that's from the past. That's just a way to make hard feelings even worse. But in doing so, he does describe some of the principles of being a good employee or being an entrepreneur. He says, "For 20 years I've been with you, and your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried. They're young. I haven't eaten of the rams of your flock." So a good employee doesn't steal from his employer. "That which was torn of the beast I didn't bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night." That might not have been the best thing on Laban's part. It says, "There I was, and the day drought consumed me, the frost by night, sleep departed from my eyes." Again, we see Jacob's an example of hard work, long hours, sacrifice for doing a good job. All those are good things. The fact that he's bringing up these past grievances isn't necessarily such a good thing. But we can look to Jacob, even in his early life, as a good example for some ways. You know, Jacob tends to be a deceiver and a manipulator when he's younger. Don't look to his example for that. But in the fact that he worked hard, was diligent, willing to sacrifice for success, you know, those are things we should want to emulate for what that's worth. Anyways, we also see the timing. Verse 41, I've been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. As I mentioned, that might be literal or might be an idiom for you changed them a bunch of times. Lest the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had been with me, you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. This seems to be mentioning two different names for God. The God of Abraham, that's one title or name, and fear of Isaac. And not afraid, like Isaac was terrorized by God, but he had that awe and respect that God deserves. And Jacob publicly acknowledged, he says, he doesn't say it, but he's showing you that it wasn't his skill that made him wealthy, it was a blessing from God. Even though he did work hard, as I said, he sacrificed and did those things, still it was a blessing from God that he had this. Laban is now going to answer with some pompous sounding words, but probably not anything that was unusual for the custom of his time. He was used to being a patriarch. So he says, these daughters are my daughters, which is true. These children are my children, meaning the grandchildren, we presume. This flock is my flock. All that you see is mine. Okay, I don't think that's accurate, but he's making the case, or the claim, it all comes from me. I'm the leader of the family, the patriarch. He says, but what can I do this day to these, my daughters, or their children? So he's saying, yeah, but it's my family. I'm not going to hurt them. He says, now therefore, come, let's make a covenant. You and me, a witness between you and me. So now, whereas Laban was used to being the patriarch, the leader of the clan, he's willing to acknowledge Jacob as a patriarch and a leader of a clan in his own right. So he's accepting Jacob as his social equal. And that's kind of a big step for a father-in-law to do that to a son-in-law. Now, I'm not sure. It's funny, my father-in-law and I have never had that type of discussion, but, you know, still, well, it's like when I go to his house, it's very clear who's the leader of the household. And when he comes to my house, it's not as clear. But that's okay. I mean, it's one of those things you want to give deference to the elder. But here, Laban is making a concession. Okay, you know, let's make a covenant, not you better submit or else. So he's seeing them as his own social level, so to speak. And they're going to erect this large stone monument. And Jacob said, so Jacob took a stone and set it as a pillar. And by the way, when they make a covenant, again, we can speculate. It mentions them eating together. So they probably sacrificed animals. Perhaps, again, the cutting animals in half and walking between them. But keep in mind, that's a perhaps. We only see one example of that in the Bible and a reference to it later. But it could have been, and it seems that it was, a practice that happened in that period. But they make this big heap of stones, and they ate there on the heap. Which is how often you get to say you ate on a heap. Laban called it Jager Sehadutha. Jacob had a better idea. He called it Galeed. Always like fewer syllables when possible, which has nothing to do with anything. But and Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore, his name was called Galeed. Also Mizpah, which, where does it, it says what it means here, witness or watching. May the Lord watch between you and me when we're absent from one another. If you afflict my daughters or if you take other wives besides my daughters. So Laban's against polygamy unless it's his daughters. But no man is with us. See, God is witness. So God is witness. So they go on to talk about this. This heap is I want to get down to verse 53 where he says, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. This seems to indicate that not only Abraham, but also his father Nahor worshiped the true God. And remember, Nahor seems to have been leaning that way. And it's implying that their father, Terah, T-E-R-A-H, worshiped the true God. which that fits with the idea all the way back in Genesis 11, verse 31, when Terah was still alive, that they left Ur of the Chaldees and went up to Haran on their way to the Promised Land. But Terah didn't make it. He died there in Haran. I wanted to pause for this because there's a scripture that indicates that Terah didn't worship the true God, that he worshiped other gods. It's in Joshua 24, verse 2. And I'm not going to turn there, but Joshua 24, 2 says Terah worshiped other gods on the other side of the flood, or many scholars think that means the other side of the river, the Euphrates. What I like to think as a reconciling is that Terah probably had worshiped other gods, and then when the true God calls Abraham and makes those promises, Terah joined him, you know, Abraham and Nahor and perhaps others in the clan were saying, okay, we're going to worship this God. This is a real God. He's talking to us and we're going to obey him. So that's a possible explanation for that apparent contradiction. Another possible explanation is a little less simpler, but not something we can be certain of. Here in chapter 31, verse 53, where it says, the God of Abraham, God of Nahor, the God of their father. Some scholars have said that should say the God of your father, meaning you, Jacob, your father, judge between us, which, you know, would mean the God of Isaac. I don't know that that really matters a great deal, but it's worth pointing that out. Okay, so Jacob offered sacrifice, called his brethren to eat bread. They ate bread. Apparently, they probably ate meat too, but bread means food in the general sense here. Early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his sons and daughters, blessed them, and Laban departed, returned to his place. You could sort of say, whew, you know, apparent crisis averted. You know, Laban's running us down and got all the men, and we could have a battle. Who knows what's going to happen? They settle it. Now they're on friendly terms. They've got a monument between them. Things are good. Except now we're going to move on to the next crisis. And God's going to give Jacob some encouragement as he's going to transition from one to another. Verse chapter 32, Jacob went on his way and the angels of God met him, and Jacob saw them. And he said, this is God's camp. He called the name of that place Mahanaim. Mahanaim means two camps, or it could be interpreted as two hosts. And actually, host is a kind of archaic word. You could say two big groups. When I think of host, I think of the person that meets me when I go into a restaurant that tells me I have to wait a half hour before I can have a seat. That's not what it means by host. In the Bible, when you see host, it means a large group of people or even an army. So we don't know why, although I speculate that God allowed Jacob to see these angels to encourage him while he's traveling. And the angels were probably always there, or at least there some of the time. It's something that we could consider. How many angels are around us? And the answer is we don't know because we can't see them. But there's a story, it's in 2 Kings chapter 6, where it involves Elisha. And you've probably, if I tell you the story, you'll remember. Elisha has the king of Syria is upset and he sends an army to capture him. And this army surrounding the hills, and Elisha's servant, which we think was Gehazi, is freaking out. Well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Elisha's calm and cool, and he prays, says, God, open his eyes. And suddenly he can see that the mountains are full of angels. And Elisha says, there's more with us than there are with them. This seems to be God showing Jacob something like that. Hey, you got help. Don't worry. Even though you're soon going to find out that your brother Esau is coming to meet you with 400 warriors. So, as I said, knowing what's coming, perhaps God wanted to encourage Jacob a little bit. You know, you're not on your own with this. It's going to be okay. And as I said, I think it's worth us thinking of that. You know, many of us have stories where we think God might have intervened and protected us, or we've heard stories of other people. You know, I don't often think about it. Usually I'm oblivious because I'm an oblivious type of person. But I'm not always thinking, oh, I've got angels right here. Usually I'm not thinking that at all. But if you do stop and think about it, a lot of times when you might be in a dangerous situation, those angels probably are there. You know, and even when you do think about it or when it's not dangerous. You know, I'm not surprised so much at when you hear the stories of, wow, I can't believe, you know, there was this near miss or something should have killed me and it didn't. I'm curious to find out when I get to talk to God of all the times where I had no clue. Like, you know, like in a Roadrunner cartoon where the anvil falls and smashes the coyote. I don't know if you guys have seen Roadrunner. You know, of course, you see that. How many times has an anvil fallen behind me and I didn't even know it was there? You know, but God intervened and kept me alive. Or I'm just a really lucky guy and that's why I'm alive. But I suspect it's more the former than the latter. Anyways, having said that, he sees that. And then, verse 3, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Once again, it's probably not called the land of Seir, country of Edom, necessarily yet, but it will be known by that once Edom has grown into a nation. And he sends him a message. He sends these messengers. He commanded them, saying, "Speak to my lord Esau." He's calling him my boss, my master. "Thus says your servant Jacob, I've dwelt with Laban and stayed there till now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male and female servants. I've sent to tell my lord that I might found favor in your sight." Now, it could be interpreted as he's bragging. "Oh, I got flocks and servants. Man, I am loaded." But it could be more likely saying he's sending message as a courtesy. "Okay, I'm coming and I'm doing fine. I don't need your help. I'm not coming to sleep on your couch and ask you to feed me." I say that, I remember when I first moved back to Ohio and slept on my sister and brother-in-law's couch for a while. Jacob, that's not going to happen. "Okay, so I'm good. I don't need you to come and help me load the U-Haul. Everything's fine. Just letting you know." And by the way, I don't know if I mentioned what we're calling, I don't know if you could read it there, Edom, Mount Seir, is probably down in this area, southeast of the Dead Sea. And Jacob's up in this area, coming down. So there's a fair distance. We don't know how long it took the messengers to get from where Jacob sent them all the way down, find Esau, then travel back. But when they come back, they've got a word. "We came to your brother Esau, and he's coming to meet you. And 400 men are with him." And Jacob, well, it says how he felt next. He was greatly afraid and distressed. Why is he greatly afraid and distressed? Last time he saw Esau wanted to kill him for stealing his blessing. And apparently he's not as confident as Han Solo when he said, surely that's a long time ago. He's forgotten by now. Now, do we know, is Esau coming to hurt him? No. Emily says no. Why do you say no? Okay, well, he doesn't hurt him. We know we've read the story before. So what I'm bringing up is there's this question. There's two ways to interpret what comes after. Some would say Esau was coming with these soldiers and he's going to teach his brother a lesson. But then when he sees him and he breaks down and he's glad to see his brother after all. But those who try to argue that point, and I'm not saying one way or the other, but there's no indication. It doesn't say that these 400 men are carrying swords. You know, it doesn't say anything about Esau wanting to hurt him. So that's reading into the story. Yeah, Emily?
I kind of parallel it to the prodigal son type thing. I know he's not obviously his son, but like he's like, I mean, it's his brother. And I'm sure that even though they had some issues, they probably still loved each other. And so, you know, he's trying to give him a proper greeting, I guess.
I think that's a good point. Andrew, did you have I thought I saw something. So yeah, whereas it's easy, and maybe I'm bringing this up because when I was younger, I used to think, yeah, they're coming, you know, that's why Jacob's afraid. And I'm not the only one to think he's coming to do him harm. Jacob obviously thinks so. And he sends gifts to try to win his favor. But we don't know that there's every reason we could believe that Jacob's fears are unfounded. Not only are they brothers, but remember, they're twin brothers. As I said, obviously fraternal, not identical, because they're very different, but you know, twins seem to have a certain bond between them. And even if they get angry, which you don't have to be twins to get angry between brothers. Am I right, David? Okay, and all the rest of you with siblings, you know, that happens. But after 20 years, you could say, man, I'm going to be glad to see my twin brother. I remember discussing this in last year's class. One of our students had an identical twin. And you could just see on her face, she was saying, yeah, that's exactly what it's like. That's something special. You know, you want to be together, you have that certain bond that's hard to break. I'd like to think that's the case. Edom doesn't bear any ill will, or Esau, I should say, his nickname's Edom. But Jacob doesn't know that, and he's worried, he's preparing for the worst. Yeah, he divided the flocks and herds and the people into two companies. I'll mention from my time studying military history, this is great wisdom from a military perspective. Basically, if you're going to have to fight, you want to concentrate your troops. So you bring them together to fight, but you disperse them to be able to travel efficiently. So he's dispersing them so that they can get out of there if they need to. So Jacob, we'll see, he trusts God, but he's also taking care. And he says here, if Esau comes on one company and attacks it, the other that's left will escape. So at least half of them are going to get away if Esau has ill intent. But Jacob doesn't just do that, he prays. Verse 9, Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your family and I'll dwell with you. I'm not worthy of the least of all the mercies and all the truth that you've shown your servant. I crossed over this Jordan with my staff and now I've become two companies. So I was all alone and had only this my walking stick for company. Now look at this, I got all these people, I can divide them in half. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, the hand of Esau, for I fear him. So Jacob is afraid and he's willing to admit it. I fear lest he come and attack the mother and children. For you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Interestingly, this is, if I've got my if I read this right, this is only the second recorded prayer in the Bible. It's not just the second time anyone prayed, but the earlier one was that servant of Abraham's who went to get a wife for Isaac, and that long prayer that he made was recorded. This is another one, and it sets us a good example. As I wanted to pause, it honors and praises God. You know, remember the model prayer that Christ gave starts off with, Hallowed be thy name. It acknowledges God, his blessings. Jacob acknowledges his own human helplessness. Basically says, I'm afraid. You know, this could hurt me. But he also is rather forward in asking for God's help and reminding him of his promises. And that's something I always say, we can do that. We can read God's promises to us and we can say, look, God, I'm not bringing this up from nowhere. Your word says this. You made the promise. I'm asking you to fulfill your promise to me. You know, and I've done that a number of times. And I think sometimes God tells me, yeah, I'm going to do that, but not right now. But other times he does it right then. I mean, and he never criticizes someone for asking him to do what he said he would do. But as I said, then Isaac will still do some things on his own. So he trusts God, asks for God's help, but then he takes measures. Also, you know, one of those things that goes to show that we don't have to trust God or do things for ourselves. It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. We can trust God and do things for ourselves in conjunction. And matter of fact, I'd say it's often smart to do that. Sometime earlier, I told that the joke about the flood and the guy, you know, saying God will save me. And God later says, yeah, I sent you a boat and a truck and a helicopter. So Jacob is ready. Verse 13, lodged that same night, and he took what came to his hand as a present for his brother. And it describes all these animals. I'll mention, I counted it up. The gift includes 550 animals. And that's still a token. It's not all that he has. And I read, some scholars say that the milk camels were especially valuable in the Middle East. I don't know if it's because they have milk, but because they have young. So that's a especially valuable gift. And he separates the drove. So as Esau's riding along, here comes, oh, here's a gift for you. Oh, that's nice. He goes a little further, here's another gift. It's kind of like most of you probably don't remember or never experienced opening presents on Christmas morning. I didn't start attending church till I was like 9 years old, so I do have some memory, and it's great ripping open one package after another. It's not great to be celebrating Christmas, but I mean, one gift after another, it's like it starts to build up. You start saying, this is fun. As a matter of fact, that brings back a memory. Maybe this is a better example I should use instead of Christmas, but I remember when Sue and I got pregnant. Well, maybe I said she got pregnant. She's the one that had to carry the baby. But, you know, because it had been so long in coming, several people had baby showers for her. And she said she felt kind of guilty. Look, they're going and throwing this party, people giving me stuff. But I remember after one of them, she said, they kept giving me stuff. And I get it, and she said, it started to be really fun. Here's another thing, you know. So I'm sure this makes Esau feel better. Again, if he had come intending to do harm, his feelings are starting to change. But I'm not sold on that interpretation. But anyways, they're coming along, and they said, yeah, this is a gift from Jacob, and he's coming behind us. So Esau knows he's going in the right direction. So I'm summarizing here what Jacob told all those servants. Let's go down to, in verse 20 says, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us, for he said, so Jacob is thinking, I'll appease him. I'll appease Esau with the present that goes before me, and then after that I'll see his face. Perhaps he'll accept me. You know, he's thinking, I hope he's not carrying a grudge. Maybe he'll forgive me. Goes to show Jacob's realizing he did his brother wrong. Remember, he's not saying so, but he's admitting he had reason to be angry with me. And so I'm trying to do what I can to make things better. And verse 22, he arose that night, took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 sons. So notice Benjamin's not born yet. Crossed over the ford Jabbok. Jabbok is one of these, it's one of these rivers that flows in up here. It's not marked on this map, actually. Yeah, there we go. If this is correct, this marks the river Jabbok between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. So he's been coming down here through the mountains. Matter of fact, here, this place is labeled Penuel, which seems to be they believe this is exactly where this story happened. So just to give you some perspective. Oh yeah, from here I can't read that. So it happened over there. Right there on that map. Anyway, so he sends them over, and then Jacob was left alone. It says in verse 24, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. And my edition here, man is capitalized because nobody believes this is a man. It's a spirit being who we believe, and he's wrestling. Later on we'll see he believes it's with God. I'm pointing out the name Penuel. That's a word that means face of God. And Jacob would name this place that because he says, well, actually, I'm trying to see. It's at the end of the chapter. If I can find it. Yeah, in verse 31, he crossed over. It's in verse 30. The name of Penuel, because he says, I've seen God face to face and my life is preserved. So Jacob realizes this isn't just some guy. And well, let me read a little bit more. A man wrestled with him till the break of day. He saw that he didn't prevail against him. He touched the socket of his hip. The socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint, and he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, the day breaks. This seems to be the man. And he said, no, I won't let you go unless you bless me. What's your name? Jacob. Your name's no longer going to be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Jacob says, well, tell me your name. He said, why do you ask my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Penuel, for I've seen God face to face. So again, some people would make the claim this was an angel, but we believe it was the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, the one who became the Word. Now, apparently he is carnate, so to speak, just as when he showed up and had the meal with Abraham, he appears as flesh and blood. Which is kind of interesting, you know, that he's able to do that. So we don't know for sure when Jacob figured this out. And we could say, why did God decide to wrestle with him? Anyone want to hazard a guess? I caught you off guard on this one. Yes, Dr. Britt?
He thought it'd be fun.
I like that one. Matter of fact, did you read the Bible, our Bible reading program, or the commentary that you see? Tom Robinson wrote much of that, and one of the things he says, you know, you can speculate on all these reasons, but if God wants to wrestle, then you wrestle. So maybe God just felt like having it, you know, it'd be fun to do. Which, it fits with my personal theory, because I believe if God could become flesh and do something like this, when we're born as spirit beings, we could be able to do that. Because I've often thought it'd be cool to get some of your friends together and become flesh again and play basketball. Only you can make yourself better than you would be. Like, I'd love it if I could actually dribble and pass, you know, not let alone even be able to shoot. But, you know, so partly it's fun. It does seem that he wants to test Jacob. Okay, because we see a test of Jacob's perseverance here. He wrestles with him all night, and he says, let me go. And Jacob says, no, I'm not going to let you go. Because we could say, obviously, God could have pinned Jacob. Right? I'm guessing he could give himself that ability. So if he wants to win, he could do it. But he limits his ability in whatever way. So we're getting into this theoretical thinking. We don't know exactly how God does these things, but apparently he let Jacob have a fair shot at it. And maybe he told him, you know, if you want a blessing, you got to stick this out. And even when he did something to injure him, and I'm saying something because it says he dislocated his hip, but scholars debate, you know, could he have really dislocated his hip? Because they say you wouldn't be able to walk. The pain would be so excruciating, you know, you couldn't carry on. I know Jacob was a pretty tough guy. You know, we could speculate if it was dislocated and put back in before he leaves. And there is different speculation as to what he did.
Possible he just caused Jacob just to have a very slight limp, so he remembers the
Yeah, in the end, yeah, he's limping. It says the muscle. So some people said it might have been a tendon or a muscle injury. I think there's speculation that he might have just smacked him in the, you know where, and which would cause pain and you'd be limping for a little while. But in any case, you know, like I said, God wanted to wrestle. Jacob hangs on. He's not going to give up till he gets this blessing. Remember, we're seeing Jacob mature. Jacob had a long history of finagling and swindling and deceiving to get blessings. You know, how did he get the blessing from Isaac? You know, he wrapped goat hair on his arms and he said, "I am Isaac." You know, he lied and cheated to get blessings before. Now he realizes God is the source of blessing. We've seen that in what he told Laban and what he's told his wives. It's evident Jacob really believes now. God is the only way I'm going to get blessings. I'm not letting go of God. Now, I could make a sermon out of that. I'm tempted to. I've only got 5 minutes. But read it to, you know, build it in for yourself. If you come to that realization that you've got an encounter with God in your life, and He's the only way to really get the blessings that you want, the simple thing to conclude then is, I'm not letting go. And there's going to be injuries. There's going to be difficulties. You're going to get exhausted. Have any of you wrestled? Most of you guys probably have, at least in gym class, right? No? I don't know if the girls, not in gym, but you wrestle. I mean, have you wrestled like competition? I went out for the wrestling team, you know, and in school. Actually, I ended up quitting because I found out all the meets would be on Saturdays. But, you know, when you do it on the thing, when you're wrestling, I mean, real wrestling, not just messing around with your brothers and sisters. You do like three-minute rounds. I think that, and it is the most exhausting thing you've ever done. You know, I remember doing it at camp, and I just did 1-minute rounds because the kids, after about 30 seconds, they can barely keep going. So the thing to wrestle all night and not let go is just mind-boggling to me. I'm getting sidetracked, but we want to make the point, we never want to let go. We want to persevere and stick with it no matter what. And he did. He got the blessing. And it's interesting, in verse 28, he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel." He's going to give him that name again later. But we'll see, God is changing Jacob's name. Who else's name had he changed? Okay, Abram has changed Abraham. Sarai has changed to Sarah. Makes me wonder, well, he didn't change Isaac's name, but God named Isaac in the first place, so maybe that's why. Israel means, it says prevailer. It can be interpreted a couple ways. One is prince with God, so prince or prevailer. But I think it's worth noting it says a prevailed with God. You've struggled with God and men and have prevailed. It doesn't say he prevailed over God. So he's wrestling with God. He didn't win that, but he stuck with it. And that's something, you know, I want to be a prevailer with God, you know, with us both on the same team. Anyways, and this isn't hard and fast, but some have noticed that in prophecy, it seems that sometimes, well, I know we sometimes see the name Jacob in prophecy and sometimes Israel. And some people have noticed that when Jacob is used, it more often seems to apply to physical things, and Israel when it's applying to spiritual. But think of that as a rule of thumb, not hard and fast every time, because it doesn't seem to work every time. It's just more often than not. So So it's one of those things, if you're reading a prophecy, it's worth thinking, if you see Jacob instead of Israel, is it saying something or not? Sometimes it might indicate, but it's not, as I said, it's not a sure positive thing. Anyways, we don't know why God wouldn't tell Jacob his name. Maybe he wants to let him figure things out on his own. Later he thinks it's God. I will mention in Exodus 6, verse 3, where God tells Moses that the forefathers didn't know him by the name Yahweh, you know, the YHWH. Exodus 6, verse 3. And again, as I'll mention when we cover that, we're left with the question, does that mean they never heard that name? Or as some people say, they heard it and might have even used it, but didn't have a deep understanding of it. I don't know, I find neither explanation to be completely satisfying because each one leaves me with questions. But we'll look at it more when we get to Moses talking to the burning bush or talking to God in the burning bush. At any rate, finish up, of course, it says in verse 31, as he crossed over Penuel, the sun rose on him and he limped on his hip. So he's been up all night. He's had a rough night and he's got a rough day ahead, although it's going to have a happy ending. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip and the muscle that shrank. And again, you can speculate on what kind of injury this was, but it's worth noting that what they're describing is a tradition of the children of Israel. And apparently it means the muscle that's on animals' hips, not humans, because there's no indication that they're cannibals. But it's not a dietary law. You know, God tells us certain animals you cannot eat, some you can. God says don't eat the fat that's on the organs, don't eat blood. But this thing about not eating the muscle that shrank, like I said, that's a family tradition. It's not a law that we need to figure out and say, oh, I better not eat that. So sometimes that question comes up, and that's our answer. Speaking of questions, anybody have any? I'm thinking this is the place to stop. Sky? Well, I think that's a lesson we can infer. We can wonder a lot of reasons, and we can guess, but it simply doesn't tell us. And the bottom line could be just, if God wants to wrestle, you got to wrestle, whatever his reasons are. Yes, Andrew?
I believe it's actually kind of a sign of his change, because he went from swindling and lying and stealing to get his blessings from God. And this was a fight. This was persevering to get the blessings from God.
I think there's something to that. And as I said earlier, we read his prayer, and we see, as I said, you watch, we see a lot of Jacob's life, and he definitely changes and matures, and that's a very positive thing.